You're about to listen to the 8-Bit Heroes podcast, sponsored by NerdLocker.com. Please visit NerdLocker.com for your nerdy news and reviews. Thank you. Enjoy.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the 8-Bit Heroes podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jacob, joined by our PR manager, Sarisa.
What's up?
And we have a special treat for you today. Today, we will have an interview with the one and only, one of the busiest men in comics, Mr. Rick Remender.
Hey, how you guys doing?
All right. Now, we're going to jump right into it, listeners. So, Rick. You know, you're a very busy man. I mean, you've been doing projects between Marvel and Image and DC right now. How do you find time to do it all?
Well, a lot of the work I have coming out right now is stuff that I've been working on since 2013. In 2013, I was really only doing two monthly books that were shipping in Uncanny Avengers and Captain America. And it was during that time, and even going back to 2012, that I was working on Low and Black Science and getting Deadly Class up and running. And in terms of the Axis event, I've been working on that story going on 2 years now. So a lot of what's coming out now has been in the has been filed and been in the works for some time, and a lot of it, you know, has been finished for some time. So it's just a whole hurricane of it all coming out sort of at the same time. So yeah. But I'm still, you know, I'm locked at the computer 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, doing the job. And, you know, I think that that'll ease out a little bit once Axis is wrapped and I've got the Avengers graphic novel with Jerome Pena wrapped. And then I'll be able to leave the house and remember what it likes to, what it's like to see the sun and things like that.
that sounds tough, honestly. I wanted to actually know, before, you were the icon, I just wanted to know how you started loving comics. What made you start saying, I want to do this?
Well, when I was 10 or 11, I think I was 11, and, me and some friends used to skate a loading dock by a 7-Eleven. And I went into the 7-Eleven to get a drink, and I saw a comic rack, and Secret Wars number 4 was on the stand, and it's the Hulk holding up a mountain and all the other heroes defeated, and I thought that was kid stuff, even at 11, and, you know, it was, oh, that's not for me. But I picked it up, and it was like, you know, all right, I'll try it. And I took it home that night and read it and loved it and was, you know, really drawn into the world and became a, you know, a Marvel zombie. As a kid, mowed lawns and worked around the neighborhood to save money up to go get Uncanny X-Men back issues and Avengers back issues and put together a collection and really just fell in love with it. And, you know, it sort of became between, between the ages of, I guess, 11 and 20, you know, I was a fanatical collector. I was really, just fell in love with the art form. And then, as I got a little older and started finding guys like, you know, Dan Klaus and the indie scene and, you know, I was sort of drawn there from guys like Robert Crumb, who had a lot of crossover appeal on the skate punk scene that I was really invested in. And, that stuff led me into, you know, finding the Vertigo and all the indie stuff. And then that was what I mostly, read and took in through my 20s. And so by the time I was a working professional, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, I think a lot of what I do is kind of a middle ground between those two sensibilities, because I've spent, you know, a decade really immersed in one and a decade really immersed in the other. So, yeah, I just fell in love with the art form and the purity of expression and the ability for just a couple of people to sit down and tell the story that they wanted and have it get out without a lot of other, you know, thumbprints on it.
Awesome.
That's awesome. that actually makes sense, the balance that you strike in your comics. Even when it is a Marvel comic, you know, you have that. It's not fully for children, but, you know, you try to keep that balance between adult and readable.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. All right. My next question is, you know, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. And when you were writing books like, you know, like Fear Agent, did you ever think that you would, you know, have risen to the level of a full-time, you know, working comics creator?
Well, I've been a full-time comics creator for 15 years. You know, it's just a lot of the other time I've had other jobs, writing video games or storyboarding or animating. But I haven't done anything else full-time since about 2006, 2007. I've written a few games, like worked on Dead Space and Bulletstorm and a few other things like that on a freelance basis since then. But I wasn't going to let anybody tell me that I could or couldn't do it. I just did it and kind of just ignored the industry and kept putting my comic books out. And fortunately, I've got a lot of really wonderful artists who are friends and who respect my writing, that they kept drawing the books for low pay or no pay, and we kept making the books year after year. So really, it's a disease. It's not something that I can stop doing. It's something that I would do whether I was being paid or not being paid to do it. It's just in me to create comic books. So yeah, I mean, as a working professional, though, I mean, I've been making a living doing this for, you know, a long time.
Good deal. Good deal. Excellent.
That's awesome. What would you say to a creator that's trying to do what you're, you know, trying to get to your level, you know, just create and see what happens? What would you tell them to start out doing?
Well, I mean, just what I started doing. I just started writing and drawing comic books, and I didn't stop. I didn't care about reaction. I didn't care about, you know, sales. I mean, obviously those things would have been nice had they been there, but they weren't for quite some time, and nor should they be while you're honing your craft and getting good at it. if you're expecting somebody else to come along and tap you on the head with a magic wand and give you something, you know, like, it happens every so often, but those are sort of the creators that end up kind of crumbling over time or drifting. You have to build a solid foundation, and you have to just create comic books, and you have to just keep creating comic books for years and years and years and years when it seems, you know, hopeless and it doesn't seem like something that's going to be rewarding financially and that you might have sunk your life into a toilet. I personally had quit, you know, I quit a job at Fox and Warner Brothers and Electronic Arts. I just kept quitting day jobs to try and focus more and more time on comic books, and that was to the financial detriment and my family's livelihood for some time. And you just have to believe in yourself and keep doing it and keep honing your craft. And if it's in you to continue to do it when no one's paying you for years and years and years, eventually you'll find your audience, you know. And I've been very fortunate in that I eventually did.
It shows that you have a lot of love for these stories. There's a lot of love in the comics, and I suppose that's what makes you such a great writer. So as fans, we appreciate you.
Oh, that's really nice to hear. I dump my ass as much as I can into every single script, and to the detriment of my health and my ability to leave the house. So it's nice to hear. Thank you.
Well, it kind of clicked now. I was like, okay, now it makes sense why stories are so, you know, gripping. So I just wanted to let you know, as a fan, I appreciate it. So.
Thank you.
Okay, now let's start bouncing into the present. All right, Rick, when, you know, with your Captain America run, which is something that, that really got me back into reading that character. I mean, I enjoyed the Brubaker run, you know, but, you know, after that, I was really wondering, you know, is this it for my, you know, for my love for the character? And reading the Dimension Z arc, for Cap really, really turned me on to the possibilities of that character, because up until then, you know, I'd really seen him as a very patriotic, very, you know, very two-dimensional character that literally did one of two things, either fought a war or fought against, you know, tyrannical oppression. And with the Dimension Z arc, it really opened up his possibilities as a character. So what were your thoughts on, you know, getting into that character?
Well, when I took the job, it was just a, it was something where I wanted to do an homage to what Jack Kirby did in the 70s when he came back to the character, and a lot of unimaginative people with no vision kind of crapped on Kirby. But it's wildly imaginative and incredibly unique and original and very smart, and it's very bold. And I wanted to try and emulate what Kirby had done when he created Zola and came back to the character that he had co-created so many years earlier. And so I wanted to pay homage to hit that spirit and to what he had done there, and also to try and dig into the heart of the character more than just tell a story about World War II. Or, you know, Ed had completely and wonderfully used the World War II and the espionage trope. And it had been going on for so long that to continue down that road felt redundant and safe. And I wanted to do something that was wildly unique while paying homage to a specific era in Cap's history, while also uncovering and digging into who the character is and why we should care about Steve Rogers as a human being. And that was sort of the mission statement as I went into it. And, you know, it was it's like with anything you do. I recognized the safer road was the espionage and keeping it grounded, but that's was not incredibly exciting, and it didn't feel like, you know, I just wanted to do a little more risk-taking with the story, and so, yeah, that was kind of the impetus for it.
Okay.
It's actually very interesting how you put that dynamic with him and his son, and, you know, it was literally very... It gave you a new way of looking at Steve. You know, oh, you're not only a soldier, you can be more. You know, you can be a dad, you can be that flat family man that nobody can really see
you. So sure. Yeah, then, you know, the stakes for Steve in terms of who he is as a person and what he is fighting against and what he is fighting for, it felt like he needed a little more connective tissue to something that felt a little bit more like a family, and it also got us a new nomad, and you know, I had the big idea for Steve and Sharon to get a little bit of peace together, as we're going to get a glimpse of coming up here, and you know, obviously the build up to Sam Wilson taking over the mantle.
Oh, awesome. I'm glad you mentioned it, because I didn't know if I was going to. I was like, maybe I'll say it, maybe I won't, but you mentioned it, so now we're there. You know, we really enjoy your Cap run, and I'm looking forward to the newer issues very much so. But moving on and switching gears, your work with Image, Black Science, Low, and, you know, I know you have some other projects that you'd like to talk about. Where are these ideas coming from? In particular, Deadly Class. It seems like such a departure from the work that you've been doing as of late, and yet it is such a well thought out and just very nuanced story.
Well, thank you. The inspiration for those books, you know, those are the kind of books that I would be making, and these are the kind of books that I was making 10, 15 years ago even. I think Deadly Class is very similar spiritually to books like Blackheart Billy and Strange Girl. I think obviously Low and Black Science are thematically similar and aesthetically similar to Fear Agent and the science fiction stuff that I started doing in 2004. But there just wasn't a market for it. And, you know, I had retailer after retailer and telling me nobody wants science fiction and it doesn't matter. And, you know, so we just bought out Fear Agent for ourselves, and we just kept it going. But now we're in a unique situation where people are interested in new ideas and science fiction and other genres. And so I normally just start with a basic high concept. You know, Black Science is anarchist who sees no value in accepting the authority of other men who will seek out the forbidden truths. And the consequences of delving into forbidden science, and Deadly Class is a high school for assassins, but it's really a slice of life, coming of age, shoegaze kind of story, amid where the knife in your back is not merely metaphorical any longer, taking the normal high school experience and sort of extrapolating from it something that is universal and real, and then the fantasy aspect of it, where it's also physically actually very, very deadly and dangerous. And Lo is just an idea that Greg and I have been working on for, you know, I guess like 4 years now. And it was just a very basic sci-fi premise that was then really grounded in character work and world building and trying to write a kind of an optimistic female lead in a setting where there was no reason to be optimistic, as kind of a metaphor for the gone through in my career coming up and in life fighting depression and other things like that. So that's like in a nutshell the sort of, you know, the basic broad strokes on those three books.
There's always some irony in most of your work. I really do want to mention how funny Deadly Class is. Like when he ate the shrooms, by the way, I was cracking up. I haven't laughed that hard in a really long time.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Oh my god, I love that issue. And in Black Science, I think it's really funny how nobody's really a bad guy, but everybody is. However you pulled that off.
Sure. Well, they're all just humans. There's nobody who's an immediate protagonist or nobody who's an immediate antagonist, and the people who are painted as antagonists and protagonists are flipped and flopped. Kind of how it is in life. I mean, good and bad in human interactions is all sort of based on who you are and what you benefit from the outcome. And I don't think that there's a lot of subjective, I mean, it's all subjective. I don't think there's a lot of objective possibility in humans' ability to, you know, to gauge that on one another. It all comes down to your perspective on that person. And so nobody's really good or bad. It's all kind of a gray soup. And that was something that I wanted to make sure and delve into with that book.
Yeah, it's like sometimes writers put others, like their character's thought process and such, and it's funny because most of the characters, you really don't know what they're thinking. You really just see their actions and sometimes what they say, but you really don't know what their values are until, you know, something happens. That was just very interesting to me in that book.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay. Now, I know that, you know, you'll have to be careful about this, but we really would like you to be able to tell us a little bit about your upcoming books. One in particular, Tokyo Ghost, which I am very much looking forward to.
Well, Tokyo Ghost is the only new creator-owned book that I have, and it's still not coming out for about a year. It comes out in July of next year, but Sean and I are working away on it now amid our various other projects so that by the time we get to that point, we've got 4 or 5 issues finished. Tokyo Ghost is something that we've been talking about for, I guess, about a year and a half now, and we talk on the phone quite a bit, and we really have tried to dig into something here that is aesthetically sort of a nod, at least at the beginning, to a love letter to things like The Road Warrior and Lobo and Judge Dredd and the sort of action, the violent, you know, the Clockwork Orange of it all, the violence, the hyper-violence. But then with something that I think will be quite unexpected to people, a turn in the second or third issue that turns the book into something completely different, while also giving us an opportunity to examine man's addiction to technology and the ramifications of what that could potentially lead to.
Interesting, interesting. And
of course, you've got, you know, Sean Murphy and Hollingsworth on the art. I could basically write anything, and it's going to be worth picking up. I mean, the pages are just spectacular. Those guys are just monsters.
Yes, yes. I've noticed that the artists you seem to be able to hook up with on these projects, I mean, oh my goodness. you know, I've, like I say, I've been a fan of your work, roughly since about Fear Agent. And, just the artists that you're able to collaborate with just blow my mind. Currently in particular, Mateo Scalera, his art on Black Science is just breathtaking. I remember reading the first issue and just seeing the designs for the, I guess the only way I can call them is the fish people.
Sure.
And, you know, it was just breathtaking. And I would love to know how does your collaborative process work? You know, do you give them the scripts and just say, draw what I see, or do you guys kind of just bounce off ideas until it, you know, becomes a wonderful salad of comics?
Well, every project is really different. You know, some of the projects, the artists want to be heavily involved and talk a lot and dig it up together. And on those books, I'm very happy to do that. As an artist myself, I know the value of the artist's vision and their buy-in to the ideas, as well as their inclusion in the conceptualization of them. I think that the each project really is quite different. I have an editor that I have brought in on my creator-owned book, Sebastian Gerner, who I work with on some of them. Like Greg Tocchini, for example, on Low, and you know, we've worked together on these of them in X-Force. We've worked together for years now. Greg is somebody who is in Brazil and speaks Portuguese, and so we have a language barrier. And so a lot of the time what will happen is he'll draw things or he'll cook things up in sketchbooks and send them to me, and I'll find ways to incorporate them. Like he'll design a character, and I'll build on that character and figure out how that character came to be and what that character's role is in the greater story that I'm telling. And it really makes, it strangely turns into the perfect collaboration. But at the same time, then there's guys like Wes Craig on Deadly Class, and we talk on the phone for hours and hours and beat the story up and beat the characters up and work together. Same with Sean Murphy on Tokyo Ghost. with Mateo, at the very beginning, I had a 20-issue outline. And I talked to him about it, and then we did a couple Skype sessions and spent all night sort of trading ideas back and forth via Skype, and a lot of those have ended up in the series as well. And so, you know, all these guys are our co-owners and co-creators, and so it's something where as much involvement as they want, excuse me, we can always accommodate and find some way to balance it. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, that's, I think, the best way to make comic books is to have a completely collaborative effort.
Sounds like a marriage. Has a lot of back and forth, and give me your idea, and we'll work together and figure it out.
Yep.
Cool. Okay. Let's see. And my next question actually has to do with your creative process. Like you said before, you know, you're mostly, you know, trapped in the Batcave, as it were, you know, until the work is done. And I really like to know, how does a day start out for you when you're, you know, about to get to work? Like, how does that work? Do you just get up and go? Or do you have a ritual that you have to start beforehand? How does that, how does that look to you?
These days, because of all of the the planets aligning and everything colliding the way that it has, I'm sort of in the midst of doing a number of things at any given time. So I usually just wake up, brew a pot of coffee, shock my system awake, and then hit the computer and deal with an hour or two or three of email. And by that point, I'm sort of awake and ready to go, and then I just start cracking into scripts. Earlier in the day, I like to work on plot stuff and art direction, because my brain is still not flexible enough to get immersed in character or interesting dialogue. And then I try to do most of my dialogue stuff between 8 p.m. and 3 a.m. I'm alone. I find that I achieve a deeper immersion in the characters, and I write better dialogue at night. So, and then I wake up and do it all over again. So, yeah, I find that when I get stuck these days, I'll just take a break and read the National Geographic or something, and it'll always inspire something in me or some idea. So yeah, that's basically where I'm at these days.
Well, basically, your best work comes out when you're sleep deprived and delusional. Got it.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know if it's I don't know. Yeah, I've been sleep deprived and delusional for so many years now. I suppose that is the recipe to success.
I heard 3 a.m. and I'm like, oh, poor guy.
Well, it beats heavy lifting or landscaping, which I did for many years.
Nice.
I'm very grateful to be able to sit in my house and sit around and be imaginative for a living. We're very lucky.
Yeah, it sounds like fun.
Okay. Now, let's see. Getting into your creative process and everything, you know, you've done work, you know, for the big two. You've done, you know, creator-owned books. Which do you find, you know, more satisfying? Do you like them equally? What is your take on, you know, on creator-owned as opposed to, you know, working with licensed characters?
Well, I obviously prefer to create my own comic books and own my comic books and run my comic books and not have a boss. I mean, it's like, you know, who wouldn't? I get to do whatever I want with brilliant artists, and, you know, I get to control it and completely benefit from any exploitation of it in other media or anything that good that happens with it. I like the process of creating new characters and new worlds with artists. I like finding new aspects of my personality and things I want to say about what's going on around me and infusing that into the characters. And that's a lot easier to do, I think, in creator-owned comics. That said, there's still the kid in me who grew up reading Marvel Comics, and I do my very, very best to try and infuse those books with the same kind of love and the same kind of immersion in character that I give to my creator-owned books, but you know, it's not exactly the same. I'm not in control of it. I can pitch it, and sometimes I get to do exactly what I want, and sometimes I get to do a variation on it, and sometimes an editor makes it better. So it can be excuse me, it can be something that is incredibly rewarding or incredibly frustrating, given the day you're doing it on. I think that there are different rewards for each. I think that the mainstream work, and when I was stridently indie and had been doing so for, you know, a decade and had a family coming and needed to start, making a little bit more money, Marvel was there, and, while that was my initial motivation, I ended up working with a number of editors who I learned a great deal from, and I also learned to respect the efforts of a great editor and the efforts of rewriting, and have somebody who is there to force you to rewrite, which is why I brought over Sebastian Gerner to my Image work, and he was my editor at Marvel for a while with Axel Alonso when we were doing Punisher and X-Force, and that was something that he and Axel and Jody LaHoop were in an office together, and Jody and I did X-Force, and Sebastian and I did Punisher, all with Axel, working with us. So I found a respect for that process and what that could achieve by having a number of people there and other set of eyes, so that you don't fall into your own sort of sense of accomplishment, or that you don't fall into sort of assuming that your work is great, which, you know, you never want to do. You always want to assume that every idea is suspect and vet it through somebody and argue it out, because what comes out on the other side is normally better. So, there's been a lot of benefits to both. Ultimately, I have a lot of fun doing both for different reasons.
Awesome. Okay. All right. Well, we're going to start wrapping it up, Rick. Now, can you kindly tell our listeners when the next issues of your various books will be coming out? It doesn't have to be an exact date, just roundabout.
Sure. Well, we've got Deadly Class starts back up, I think, next week when issue 7 comes. And then Black Science comes out in 3 weeks. Low comes out in 3 weeks. And then at the same time, we have Axis launching, which is a triple shipping book, which means three issues a month. And on top of that, we have the all-new Cap launching. So October and November are busy months for me in terms of output. But that stuff's all coming out in October, November, and hopefully will continue to keep coming out if I don't have a heart attack.
All right. There we go.
I appreciate it. If you didn't do that, we still enjoy your work.
I'll try.
Fully alive.
I'll strive to stay fully alive.
I would agree. Thank you so very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us, and we are honored to have that experience.
Okay. Well, thank you guys for your support, and I appreciate the interest.
All right. And Rick, if the listeners want to see more of your work, or they want to, bounce feedback off of you or tell you how much they love your books, what social media or sites can they reach you on?
The only place I am accessible on the internet is Twitter, and that is where I update all of my comings and goings and doings. And I try to update rickremender.com at least a couple times a month, but Twitter is normally a better source of that. So either one of those places is where you can get the skinny.
All right. Good deal. All right. And listeners, you can reach us at the podcast on nerdlocker.com or via Twitter at 8bitheroes or on Facebook at facebook.com/8bitheroes. So we appreciate Rick taking the time out to talk to us, and we just want to tell him thank you and tell Image Comics thank you, and really tell our PR manager, Sarisa, thank you, because without her, this would not be possible.
Oh, shucks. Thank you, guys. Actually, I do nothing except bother people. Always say yes to me. Thanks, guys, and thank you, listeners. You know where to find me on Twitter, so... you guys next week.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, guys. See ya.
Bye.